my tomorrow.
Are you ready?
Friday to my life.
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
It looks like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on First Amendment Friday. Every subject is fair game, so your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. We'll get into the details of that. I want to tell you about a colossal failure of a major police agency here in the Pacific Northwest. They promised DNA analysis in days, and now they have backlogs that go back literally years. That's one issue to talk about. I'm also going to talk a little bit later about a sports columnist. You know how little I cover sports on this show, but a sports columnist from one of the biggest newspapers in America that decided to walk away from that job because the paper kept spiking his columns, especially when he wrote about whether or not young ladies, girls, and women should have to compete in sports against biological males. Now, it's a familiar topic for us, but apparently the woke Daily Dead Fish rapper, in this case the Seattle Times, decided we're not going to run that column. And they thought they could keep on doing that. And I think he smartly said, you know what, then I'm not going to work for you anymore. And he walked away from the job. I'm going to be talking to him later on my national radio show. But this is the kind of environment we're living in right now, where people on the woke side of things are afraid of ideas to the point where they say, we're so afraid of that idea, we will not even put it on paper or in this day and age onto the Internet. So that's on the agenda as well. And then our X poll question, should we provide asylum to people who need to be told not to rape? Now, the problems kind of come to a head in Great Britain. In the United Kingdom, they literally have government offices that are issuing pamphlets telling some of the asylum seekers, these are people who've come to Great Britain because they said, I'm being persecuted in my own country, so I've come to your country, and they need to be told, please don't rape women when you're in our country. It is that bad. Should we provide asylum to people who need to be told not to rape? And I think my answer to that would be no. We should not provide asylum to those people. Those people are their own worst enemies, and we don't need to bring them into our countries. And I would apply that to the United States as well, although the United Kingdom seems to have a much more pronounced problem when it comes to Muslim rape gangs, although there's no saying that the United States won't eventually be up against the same kind of problem. But I think the United States has people in it that would respond perhaps a little less genteelly than the British have. You can find the X poll question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, let me tell you about this colossal failure. The Oregon State Police, and I will give full and lavish credit to the fish wrapper in this case, OregonLive.com. The story about how Oregon State Police promised, we will analyze DNA, we will quickly go out and help police agencies find the bad guys, and we might be able to start catching some really serious criminals in as quickly as 30 days after a crime occurs because of DNA evidence. And then they go on to profile a number of cases, and they say DNA swabs that sat unexamined, not even looked at, for as long as 3 years at the time. And by the time they got back with the DNA tests, they compounded the failure because it was too late. The statute of limitations had already run, and that meant you could not prosecute the case. And the Daily Dead Fresh Wrapper, OregonLive.com, says the Oregon State Police had touted their forensic problem, which was launched statewide February of 2021, 5 years ago, as a way to quickly identify and prosecute property crime offenders through DNA analysis. It told local police departments they would be able to turn around the evidence in as quickly as 30 days. The program now has a backlog of more than 3 years with nearly 2,000 cases that are awaiting examination. And it gets worse because, as I suggested a moment ago, a lot of these cases, if they involve property crimes, not crimes against persons, not rapes, not murders, but if they involve property crimes, the statute of limitation for many of those crimes runs out in 2 or 3 years, which means with a 3-year backlog, in many, if not most of the cases, by the time they get the evidence analyzed and they find out who the bad guy was, they can no longer prosecute him. They said when it announced the initiative more than 5 years ago, the state police said they would increase efficiency and provide law enforcement agencies with meaningful DNA results in a timely manner. The state police were confident in making that declaration because the program had changed how they handled the evidence. They made it much more direct to be able to send the evidence in to the state police crime lab and allow local agencies to collect DNA swabs so they could quickly be analyzed. But so far this year, the state police forensic crime lab has already had to close or cancel more than 160 pending cases without even analyzing the DNA. Why? Because the statute of limitations had already expired, or because the cases had already solved the case some other way. In other words, the DNA ability became absolutely meaningless. And then appeals, which in Oregon is overwhelmingly screaming left-wing liberals. These are people appointed for about 40 years by the Democrat governors of the state of Oregon. And they sit on the Court of Appeals and they change the law. So in this case, there is a case called State versus Weiderman. And why is that important? Because at the end of the case, they said if you're going to have DNA evidence, you have to have the primary forensic analyst be able to testify. You can't just have somebody from the lab come in and say, well, our lab examined the evidence and this is what we found. DNA scientists have spent more time in court over the past year, which reduces the amount of time that they have for actually being able to analyze the evidence. So you burn up all of your time sitting in a court because the Court of Appeals said you can't just have somebody come in who's read the report, who has the evidence, who understands what's going on. No, you've actually got to have the primary forensic analyst. That ties up time and resources, and it means those cases do not get solved. And if anybody thinks that makes sense, you're probably a defense attorney, and I'd love to take the naysayer call. Anyway, glad to get your phone calls and emails. It is First Amendment Friday, so every subject is fair game. If you want to jump into what we've always called the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And our X poll question, should we provide asylum to people who need to be told don't rape women? The X-Poll question is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Yesterday, we asked you, would you buy a home in a neighborhood where flock cameras and your HOA tracked every car coming and going? 90% of you said no. Only 10% of you said yes to that question. Glad to have you with me. It is First Amendment Friday. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Parking lot in Dunk.
If you don't want to talk but want to be heard, email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. He actually will read it. Now, here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
Hey, do you think that voters will see through the fraud being peddled by Congresswoman Marie Gluzin-Camporez this time? I certainly hope so, and I've got a dog in the fight. I'm happy to announce that I live in Washington's 3rd Congressional District, and I certainly don't think that Perez represents citizens well. Perez has carefully crafted created a blue-collar image for herself. She even shows up in grease monkey attire, allegedly connected to the auto repair shop that she owns along with her husband. That despite the fact that she has described her own role at the shop as doing spreadsheets and baking cookies for the crew. This young lady graduated from a notoriously bizarre private college in Portland where tuition costs more than $70,000 a year. Does that sound very blue-collar to you? Her parents paid the bills for Perez, much like the backgrounds of fellow traveler socialists like Katie Wilson of Seattle and Zohran Mamdani of New York City. And two of her key votes this year, voting no on the SAVE Act to require voter ID and citizenship in elections, and voting no on extending the big tax cuts, are saving average families thousands of dollars. That tells me all I need to know about Member of Congress Marie Perez. My vote this year for congressional representation will be going to John Braun. Our question of the day, brought to you by the Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's actually causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Voting activist Right Side Rebel, the group, posted today, Oregon voting fraud, 397 voters registered in Douglas County in a single day. Turns out 40 of them are confirmed deceased, 129 of them are over 100 years of age, and one already voted after death. So, what did they find out? They went and confronted County Clerk Dan Loomis, who registered 397 voters in a single day. He said he couldn't remember specifically why he would have registered such a large number when the usual number is around 3 new registrations per day. It's only the beginning. The people of Douglas County and Oregon deserve clean voter rolls and straight answers, but I don't think we're very likely to get them. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to the whole idea that it's global warming that's driving all the wildfires in the Pacific Northwest. Consider this from Oregon Catalyst and the Taxpayers Association of Oregon, who looked at the record. They said Oregon wildfires have been breaking records this year. The wildfires have now burned 2.63 million acres of land. That is close to four times the annual average. So if you say, well, that's because of global warming. Well, if it's because of global warming, why is it that the number of fires and the number of acres burned worldwide has dropped 24% in the past 20 years? That's 2001 to 2020. According to the Global Fire Emissions Database, global trends show the world approaching new lows in wildfires. Since the data was first reported in 2001, the rest of the world manages its forests. Oregon does not. Oregon has four times the number of fires. Now, to your calls. It is First Amendment Friday, and if you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Jeremy, you tell my producer you're a naysayer. What do you and I disagree about that makes you one?
Hey, Lars. First of all, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think you're kind of on the wrong side of some of the forestry information you put out there. Several points would be the state that we're in, as far as forestry goes, is tightly packed plantation style trees. Those fires are known to burn much, much hotter, much faster than old growth mixed, second growth mixed forests. I mean, that's just a fact. Densely populated.
Yeah, they should be thin, and there should be more logging. Would you agree? Would you agree there should be more logging?
Well, more logging would not be, then you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, because 2% of our trees, 2% of all these trees, you keep saying, oh, we have way more trees than we did 100 years ago.
We have way more trees than we had 500 years ago, too. So what? But I'm trying to understand your point. Do you want the forest to be thinned out or not? And if you don't thin them through logging, tell me how you're going to thin them out.
Well, I wouldn't say that we should be in the type of thinning that we're doing now, because we are not allowing the trees to grow enough so that, one, that they could become an actual carbon sink. 2% of our trees.
No, because they're going to burn before they ever become a carbon sink. They're going to burn. So if the solution is to go back to logging the way we did it from the 50s through the 80s, when we had almost no fires at all, when there was active management and active logging, that's the solution I would like to see. And you've said, no, what we have to do is let these trees grow long enough. Well, they're going to burn before they get that old. You understand that, right?
Well, because they keep putting them in so tightly together, and they're monoculture trees. They're only planting a couple of types of trees. I mean, seriously, it's not like they're putting back in what was there in the 80s and the 70s. They're not putting back what was in there in the 80s.
Douglas firs? Douglas firs have been the predominant trees in the Pacific Northwest for a long time. Do we have some other species?
Had,
we do. But that's the predominant tree in the Northwest.
But they also had natural spacing. They were allowed to get much larger, which is way more effective.
What do you call natural spacing?
Because
understand, Jeremy, what is natural spacing? When there's natural reproduction of trees, you know, whether you plant them manually or whether you let natural seeding happen, you're going to have, in some cases, too many trees in one area. The only way to fix that problem is to go in and thin out the trees as they get bigger. Keep the good ones. Cut down the little ones.
Have you been in an old growth forest?
Yes, I have.
It's practically dark in there, and there is almost no underbrush. A very old growth forest.
Well, you know why there's no underbrush. You can't have brush grow where the sun can't reach. So if you have a true old growth forest and an overstory that keeps the sun out, of course you're not going to have any brush. The problem is you're saying we've got to let them get that old.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news interviews, podcasts, local and national news. Get it all at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's First Amendment Friday. I want to take a moment, though, to talk about an issue that I get lots of emails from people who say, I've got a concern about something going on in my community. And we hear those kinds of emails from all three of the states that we serve with this Radio Northwest network. That's Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. One of them came from Wendy Gilbert, who is a spokesperson for the Ridgefield Preserve the Waterfront Group. Ms. Gilbert, welcome to the program. And I kind of come to this one without drawing any conclusions right up front about whether I'm on your side of this one or on the other side of this one. I want to hear more about the issue. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Lars. Thanks for having me. And let's see if I can convince you.
Okay, very good. Because you wrote and said the community of Ridgefield has spoken clearly. We want to protect the wildlife refuge, preserve its character, and make thoughtful decisions about development. And you're not in favor of the kind of waterfront development that apparently the Port of Ridgefield has in mind. Now, I will say this. I don't live in Ridgefield, but I know the community well, and it's growing like a weed. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of development that's going on there. So when I hear somebody say, well, no, but please don't develop it this way, what's going on that's got people upset?
Yeah, so if you've ever been to Ridgefield or any of the listeners who have been, they probably know that our waterfront is special. It's not just like the other parcels of land along the freeway or in any part of town. It's one of our crowning jewels of our community. It sits alongside the Ridgefield National Wildlife Refuge along Lake River, where we have our boat launch, trails, beautiful open space that we all use for recreation, boating, fishing, walking, observing nature. So this is, I want to make sure it's clear, this is a special part of our community. And it's actually a piece of the reason that a lot of us were drawn to this area and the people continue to move there. So I think because of that, this is where it really got to much of our community, where the development, we understand, needs to happen. Ridgefield has been growing like crazy. We understand. We want it to be thoughtful, and we want it to be done responsibly. And when we see a development at the scale and magnitude that the port is proposing at the waterfront...
Wendy, you got to do a favor for my audience. They don't know what this is. So you need to tell them What it is that they're planning to do with the waterfront, you know, that's bothersome. Sure. You know, in other words, if people think of the waterfront in Seattle or the waterfront in Portland, Portland doesn't make much use of its access to the water. It's kind of a, you know, it's a pathetic use of the waterfront. It has a park on one side and a freeway on the other side. So not much there. Mm-hmm. What are they proposing to do to your waterfront that people find troublesome?
So the initial proposal that came out had multiple, probably 9 to 10 apartment buildings that could be up to 75 feet tall. That's 6 to 7 stories. It has a hotel, a 58-room hotel, which in comparison for us, is the Kalama one, McMiniman's, is smaller than the one that the port is proposing. So 58-room hotel, office space, mixed-use buildings, commercial. So very densely developed, you know, large scale. And we're going from right now it's open space with, you know, lots of nature where we'd be going to full of concrete. There is, I will have to mention, there is going to be a 9-acre park that they're partnering with the city on. So along the public access waterfront, there will be a park, but everything else is going to be pretty densely developed. And that was what shocked us all, because in 2022, the port actually surveyed the community asking, what do you want to see of this waterfront? And looking back on it, many residents after taking it felt like it was a little bit biased and leading, because we were forced to rank things that we didn't want, commercial buildings such as a hotel and apartments. But when the results of that survey came out, it was really clear the community didn't want apartments. Actually, housing was the lowest ranked use for the waterfront. Recreational open space was the highest ranked. And, you know, even the port shared those results.
Is it fair to say you want nothing built there?
No, we are not anti-development. We understand. I mean, some people would definitely prefer that, but we do understand if there's a need to redevelop, we can support that if it's done so responsibly and thoughtfully to the surroundings, the sensitive environment around it with the wildlife. And then also, Ridgefield is still, our downtown is still a small downtown. We have one road in and out. We have one access point to the waterfront. It's not right off the 5. It's, you know, down our road, our Pioneer Road, and
I've been there plenty of times. It's a great little town. Such a tiny little road in and out seems really like nobody's thinking for the future anyway, because I think you're going to end up with gigantic amounts of traffic and everything else.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm just wondering, if you don't want it, so you want it, you say you want it to be natural, preserve its natural character. Well, that means no hotels and no apartments, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. We don't want hotels and apartments, but there's other ways to develop.
So it is fair to say you don't want anything built there.
No, I think that when we've spoken to the community, because as an organization, we've gone out to events, we live here, we engage, we're even going door to door asking.
Then what do
residents.
You want built there? Because I don't want to run out of time without you telling my audience.
Oh, sorry. Oh, yeah.
You wrote to me and said you want to preserve its natural character. That sounds to me like don't build anything there. And then you said, but we do want something built there. And I said, okay, then what do you want built there?
Well, we would support something that allows for more open space, public parks, even, you know, a local heritage museum that draws in the history, something that connects to the surroundings, wildlife viewing, restaurants. We would be okay with a few restaurants. I think a lot of, because when I'm trying to share this, I'm wanting to speak for the community and not just me. What we've heard from the community is they would like small shops, local shops, something that supports our local community versus outsourcing the entire parcel to a developer out of Portland who's going to have control over everything. So there are other ways to build that we would support, and that's what we've been sharing with the Port of Ridgefield since this conception came out, and we're met with nothing really. I mean, not a lot of response and not a lot, you know, basically telling us we can't influence phase one is confirmed. And so that's where the big problem is.
Where they've got the deal with Palindrome that apparently the Port of Ridgefield made years ago and said, we're going to go ahead with this developer because we've been talking about this for years, right?
Well, they didn't select the developer years ago. That was actually recent, and they have not signed a development agreement. That's why we are all in right now. No agreements have officially been signed. They are just in the negotiation part, and so they have an exclusive agreement to negotiate with Palindrome.
Is your group going to work to stop that development?
With Palindrome?
Yes.
Yes, we do not want them to use palindrome for many reasons.
Okay, then my next question to anybody whoever says, I want to stop this, is what are you going to propose instead?
We're actually working on a full concept for the waterfront so that we can share. Like, this is what the community would get behind, and that is something that we would like them to parcel out pieces of the property instead of giving it all to one developer. Let's go smaller scale. Let's parcel out one piece and have a local contractor or some, you know, more local developer do a restaurant and things like that, where the money, you know, if they're supporting and they need to.
We're going to stay in touch with you, Wendy, and I appreciate you coming on. That's Wendy Gilbert, spokesperson for Richfield to Preserve the Waterfront. About selling your home.
If you're surrounded by Northwest liberals,
I cannot stand these morons any longer. If you don't come with me this instant, I shall run amok.
Come to the place where common sense prevails, the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I mentioned Marie Gluzenkamp-Perez earlier today. She's running for re-election to represent, and she called it representation, of the 3rd Congressional District in Washington State. And I got a note, and it said, Lars, if you read this on the air, keep my name out. And I will do that. Not sure if you've seen what is the only ad I've seen for Marie Gluzenkamp-Perez, but apparently her campaign paid Hulu quite a bit to run the ad, as it runs every single ad break on every show I watch on Hulu. No surprise that ad Hulu is owned by Disney. The ad itself is a picture of leftist irony as it asks, are abortion rights safe in Washington? And it answers, not if John Braun is elected, in an ominous tone. Meanwhile, the video playing shows Marie Gluzenkamp-Perez walking alongside and appears to be talking to a woman that is 3 trimesters pregnant, with the audio statement about abortion. What is the conversation they're having? How to abort her nearly full-term baby? There's no other messaging in this ad. It's the only ad I've seen now hundreds of times for Marie Gluzenkamp-Perez. So the Democrats' only issue outside of Trump seems to be killing babies. Is there nothing else they'd like to address or talk about with their constituents? Roads, jobs, the economy? It both amazes and disgusts me. And I appreciate the email, and I don't mind leaving your name out of that. Oh, and then this one, Craig Lars. I'm listening to the conversation on the port development in Ridgefield. You mentioned that you're very familiar with Ridgefield. With that in mind, I'm sure you'd agree it's ludicrous to think that the city street to the port property can support the traffic that would be added. I mentioned that they built a severely undersized set of streets leading into that city, and they're constrained because the construction on both sides of the street is going to keep them from building anything wider. The leaders of Ridgefield care little for the current residents of the city. I live directly across the street from a 150 home development. There's been almost nonstop semi-truck traffic and building going on for over 2 years. When they compacted the dirt for the 50-foot high fill to build homes, my windows were vibrating like a ZZ Top bass drum. It has been a nightmare. When they show how they can support traffic for port development, I'll listen. Until then, I am opposed. And Melinda wrote in. She heard Jeremy talk about logging, about how we've got to preserve the trees. You know, we are in an era right now where it is routine for Oregon and Washington to see 1 million acres go up in flames every year. This year, Oregon is at new records with 4 times the usual amount of fires. And Jeremy was saying, well, we've got to let those trees get older. And I said, they're going to burn. You have to do active management of forests. When we did that, we had 30 years from the mid-50s to the mid-80s with one fire bigger than 10,000 acres. In fact, I got a note from our friend Bob Zyback the other day, because I always check the numbers that I'm using to make sure that they are correct. And here's what Bob wrote back. Lars, we went 36 years with only one fire more than 10,000 acres. The 1951 Vincent Creek fire was 30,000 acres. The Tillamook fire was about 32,000. The 1945 Tillamook fire was 182,000 acres. Between 1970 and 1990, my Eddyville-based forest reforestation business did 20,000 acres of prescribed fires without a single acre of slop over. One of my crews spent a day extinguishing a Boise Cascade prescribed fire that crossed their fire line. That was our total experience with wildfires during those 20 years. That's from Dr. Bob Zyback. And so we go from an era where you have almost no fires whatsoever to an era where we have fires hundreds of thousands of acres are expected to burn every single year. That's on that note on First Amendment Friday. Go to John, who's a naysayer. John, what do we disagree about today?
Well, to answer, to make a quick comment, it's all global warming, the fires. You made a misstatement earlier in the week, and I want to discuss that with you. You claimed that in Oregon that people have a right to fish and hunt. You know, it's they have a mere privilege because Queen Kotek owns all the animals and wildlife in the forests. And I'm glad to see that there's a group that's recognized that, and they want to get they want to put the right to hunt and fish in the Constitution of Oregon.
Okay, fair enough. That's Drazen's idea, and I fully support it. So I don't know when you think I said, you know, well, we have a right to hunt. There's nothing in the Constitution right now that says we have a right to hunt. So I don't know where you heard that, but okay, I'll take your word for it. Let's go to Terry. Hey, Terry, thanks for the call from Grants Pass. Thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yeah, well, I just want to comment on your last guest that you had on there, the Northwest Liberal, where, you know, I bet you she's one of the first people to complain that there's no housing for people, but then she's part of the problem when she doesn't want to build housing for people.
Yep. Well, and that's part of the problem. I mean, that's what I was kind of suggesting. I was being nice to Wendy because I don't know her, but she had written to me and said, we're concerned about this, and I was cute because even during the interview, you could tell, I asked her, so you want nothing built there? And she said, no, it's not that we want nothing built. And I said, well, then what do you want built there? Well, we want the area kept all natural. Well, okay, that all natural means you don't want anything built. You don't want a hotel built. You don't want apartments built. You don't want other housing built. And yet she's in an area of the Northwest that has an explosion of housing that's going on. And as you point out correctly, we have a shortage of housing in the Pacific Northwest. That's one of the reasons we have some of the highest housing costs in the United States of America. So what do you want built instead? And the answer is nothing or something, but we can't quite describe it. But don't let anybody develop things, but then, you know, we don't have enough housing. It's a mixed bag
and
of things.
They probably prefer low income housing there and something like that. You know, propose something like that. She'd probably love it.
Probably. And you know, the terrible thing about this, Terry, there have been some really, and thanks for the call, there have been some really good studies that have been done that said if you, instead of building the low-end housing and saying, here's the low-income housing, why don't we build some housing and just let the marketplace sort it out on its own? Let's go to Greg. Greg, we're close to the break, so what's on your mind on this First Amendment Friday?
Well, I'm sorry I got a lot here, but back in the day, I'm talking back in the 70s.
Greg, if you're going to go into the history of Western Civ, we're never going to get it before the break. What's the point you want to make?
Well, I guess I don't have time.
Well, you can make the point, but when you say back in the day, what is it you're trying to get to?
These forests being overstocked. You're right. They need to be thinned. They need to be limbed up high. The best quality of wood is in a tree, that's these older trees. And here's something to think about. In the outer one-third of the rind on that tree is over half of the volume.
The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101. Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
It looks like the Canadians are here.
866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Friday.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. It is First Amendment Friday, and every subject is fair game. Now, imagine this. You've got states that claim that they control the things that happen within their boundaries. But does a state have the right to set wages in factories that are 1,000 miles outside its borders? And where exactly does the state's power actually end? There's a perfect story that illustrates this, and I'm glad to talk about it with Wilson Freeman, who's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Ms. Freeman, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Thank you. I'm good, Lars. Thanks for having me.
Have I overstated it in saying that the state of Oregon in this case is claiming the right to control employment rules and employment laws for people who are working hundreds or even 1,000 miles outside of the boundaries of Oregon? How do they do that?
No, I don't think you've overstated it. I mean, what they're doing, the state of Oregon has always had this law, this what they call a prevailing wage law. So if you work on a public works, you know, you have to be paid a minimum wage that's determined by the prevailing wage. I mean, really, this is about protecting unions, right?
Yep.
But now what they've done is they've expanded it to apply not just to people who work on the site. So, you know, public works in Oregon could be a school, could be a hospital, could be whatever it may be. But it now applies to anybody who's engaged in fabrication or manufacturing of anything that goes into that site, you know, if it's what they call bespoke. So what that means for the people who live in Oregon is public works are going to become more expensive, right? Because now Oregon is claiming that if you, say, want to build a hospital in Portland and you have a component of that hospital, which, you know, you want to manufacture in Boise, they're saying that Oregon can tell that factory in Boise what the minimum wage it can pay its workers. They're saying they have to pay them the prevailing wage in Oregon where that hospital is going to be. And that's a brand new thing. That's something that we've never seen before. So the prevailing wage is now expanding just from the project site to factories that are far away.
Now, Mr. Wilson, I'm not an attorney, but isn't there something called the Interstate Commerce Clause that says states aren't allowed? And I don't know if that one doesn't apply, then please feel free to tell me. But it sounds like Oregon's trying to say we have the right to affect things not just that happen within our boundaries, but even where somebody makes something somewhere else in America, like you said, in Boise, let's say, and then the product is brought to Oregon, that they have the right to dictate how that product is manufactured or what you have to pay the workers who are doing the job.
That's right, Lars. So the Constitution has something called the Interstate Commerce Clause, and that basically provides that Congress determines or Congress governs interstate commerce. So when states try to interfere with interstate commerce too much, that violates what the Supreme Court has called the so-called Dormant Commerce Clause. So, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. The Constitution provides that Congress is in charge and states can't get involved in that. And that's where Oregon's violating the Constitution here. So, I mean, look, what Oregon says is Oregon says, well, hey, these are our public works. You know, they're being built in Oregon. If you want to, if you want to ship a product here into Oregon that we're going to put in our public works, if a municipality of Clackamas County wants to order, a modular part of their new hospital or new school from a factory in Boise, well, that's fine, but they're going to have to pay Oregon wages. That's protectionism, Lars. That's like, imagine if all of the 50 states started to put tariffs on the products coming in from other states. You know, then what are you looking at? You know, all of a sudden the United States doesn't look so much like a country. It looks like 50 different countries, and that's not what the founders had in mind. And that's why Congress is supposed to have authority here.
Well, and one of the things that I notice on this is you've talked about the bigger projects like hospital projects, but governments are getting increasingly involved in housing, and modular construction of housing is becoming more popular, and some of the laws are making it better. Well, for instance, you could buy a double wide, you could buy a single wide. Now you're apparently able to buy modules that you can add not just horizontally, but vertically as well. And as those become more popular, does that mean that when the state of Oregon has some low-income housing and is being built as modules somewhere else, that they'll be able to dictate how the work is done and how the workers are paid in projects like that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The way that this was pitched was that, oh, well, you know, we're going to carve out affordable housing, right? This is only going to apply, it's not going to apply to affordable housing. But in fact, the exception in the rule that does apply to affordable housing, or that supposedly covers affordable housing, is so vague and so confusing. That's one of the things we're suing on, Lars. You know, it's not clear to us what the scope of that exception is. It seems to us that Oregon hasn't made clear that affordable housing or housing in general is really carved out, because Oregon is saying, well, you know, some housing is accepted, but not if it's built for the project, not if it's got any customization that's a part of it. But I'll tell you, almost all projects have customization. And, you know, that's why we've gotten involved here. That's one of the reasons we've gotten involved here.
Well, and the other piece to this is giving money back to its taxpayers. It has cut its tax rates. It's made itself an attractive place to do business, which they're able to do. Washington and Oregon could do the same. They've gone the opposite direction. They've decided to increase regulations and increase taxes. This would allow Oregon to say, well, one of the advantages Boise might have, for example, is that workers don't have to make as much money in Boise to work on a project. We'll jack that up to take the advantage away from the state of Idaho.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what we call the sort of protectionism, right? And that's precisely why the Supreme Court has the Dormant Commerce Doctrine, right? It's to prevent states from discriminating in favor of their own producers, right? What Oregon is trying to do here is they're trying to protect in-state union labor from precisely that sort of competition, from low-wage places, and not just Boise, but even other countries, right? Even potentially if you're in a far-off country, you have to look at this new law, this new rule from Oregon, and you have to wonder, well, wait a second. I mean, do I have to figure out what the prevailing wage is in Portland? You know, my factory's in Hamburg. So, I mean, it's a real head scratcher that Oregon thinks they can do this.
Well, I guess they're going to find out in court, aren't they? Ms. Freeman, thank you very much. That's Wilson Freeman, who's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. By the way, this segment of the Lars Larson Show is brought to you by eLegacy. You spend your whole life building up your wealth. Don't leave it unprotected. Set your kids or grandkids up for success by creating a customized estate plan with eLegacy. Go to eLegacyLars.com and set up a complimentary consultation. That's eLegacyLars.com. Glad to have you with me, and always glad to take your calls. Imagine this. Imagine a government that has to actually advise so-called immigrants who've come to your country seeking asylum, in other words, illegal aliens. If you have sex with somebody without their consent, that's called rape, and rape is a serious crime. If you've got to tell those people that, should they be coming to your country?
Police activity.
At the KXL News Desk with your Friday.
Right now, you might find yourself.
Ah, taxes. What say you, Robin Hood?
So you think you're overtaxed? Overtaxed, overworked, and paid off with a knife, a club, or a rope?
Why, you speak treason.
Fluently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Our ex-poll question on this First Amendment Friday. Should we provide asylum to people who need to be instructed not to rape women? I would say no to that. And if you wonder, well, that's kind of a crazy question, Lars. Where are these asylum seekers who have to be instructed not to rape women? Well, for the most part, they're part of rape gangs in the United Kingdom. In Great Britain, the so-called Home Office has now released what they call informational pamphlets and posters. They did this the day before yesterday to inform asylum seekers in Great Britain that there are laws against rape and female genital mutilation, believe it or not, and forced child marriage, among other things. A pamphlet issued by the government explains that even if a family member of a woman, like a husband or a father or a brother, may not prevent a woman from working or stop her from studying or control her clothing or restrict her free movement or prohibit her from seeing friends or family or make decisions on her behalf without consent. It goes on to say, get this, this is a government publication in Great Britain. Haven't seen it yet in the United States. But the government publication titled Sex and Consent explains that, quote, rape is a serious crime. Yeah, no kidding. Defined as having sex with somebody without their consent. The guidance explains that consent requires both people to agree freely without pressure or threats. If you've been following this the way we have on this program, you understand that Muslim rape gangs in Great Britain are a gigantic problem. Now, here's what I saw in the, I think this is from the Federalist today. If a foreigner needs to be told that women should not be raped, it's already clear that they are never going to be able to fully assimilate into a culture. A pamphlet is not going to make a difference. And I would agree with that as well. So the question that we're asking in the X-Poll is, if you've got asylum seekers who are saying to a country like Great Britain or like the United States, in my own country, I am persecuted. I am seeking a place to be safe. I want to find asylum. I want refugee status. Should we provide asylum to people who need to be instructed not to rape women in the country that is offering them asylum? I think we should not provide asylum to people like that because they are never going to be able to assimilate into the mainstream culture of countries like the United States or Great Britain. Consider the fact that the UK government even had to put out guidelines begging asylum seekers not to rape the native women should be enough reason to stop all asylum proceedings for third world foreigners. And I couldn't agree more on that issue. To your calls now on this First Amendment Friday, I want to start with Ernest. Hey, Ernest, welcome to the program. What's on your mind, sir?
How are you today, Lars? I called the other day, but they said you were out. I was hoping if you were feeling fine, I was praying for you, so it sounds like you are.
You were very generous. So, I only took a few days off to enjoy a little summertime road trip with my wife and my adult daughter.
That's nice. You need that. You need it.
Yeah.
And you deserve it.
Thank you.
Now, this is something I want to talk about, Donald Trump and his racism. Donald Trump wanted to remove a black serviceman. He don't want them to put his name on this new aircraft carrier, black man who was in Pearl Harbor, who saved a lot of people there, jumped on a machine gun, and fought off as many Japanese as he possibly could.
Now,
and
hold on, Ernest, Ernest, I hate to let facts get in the way of a good, Ernest, I hate to let facts get in the way of a good rant. I'm willing to bet you heard this from the Clinton News Network, CNN, because they've got this story and they are so completely wrong about what they plan to do with the name of, they called him Dory. His name technically was Doris, but he went by Dory Miller. And Doris Miller is his formal name, but they referred to him as Dory Miller. Do you know who first announced that his name would be on an aircraft carrier?
Oh, who was that? CNN?
That would be the acting Secretary of the Navy at the time, appointed by Donald Trump by the name of Thomas Modley. He was acting Secretary of the Navy when he announced this in January of 2020 during an MLK Day ceremony. And here's the quote. Dory Miller was the son of a sharecropper, and he was an American sailor, so designated by the uniform he wore, the same uniform all sailors wore and still wear, regardless of race, ethnic background, or political persuasion. And he announced that his name would go on a new aircraft carrier that's being built. It's one of the Gerald Ford class of aircraft carriers. Do you know where CNN got the idea that the name would not be Dory Miller on that ship?
Where did they get it from?
Well, they claim they have three sources, but here's the document they're referring to. You know that every Navy ship has both a name like Doris Miller, and they also have a designation. In the case of aircraft carriers, this one is CVN, like Charlie Victor Nancy 81.
I was on a carrier.
Okay, so you know that's the official designation of that ship is CVN 81. Well, apparently they say that there is a memo that was written by the White House that refers to putting in place on that aircraft carrier a an electromagnetic aircraft launch system for the airplanes on the carrier instead of a steam or hydraulic system, and that it only refers to the ship as CVN-81. So therefore, they somehow got the idea that the name Dory Miller, Doris Miller, which was announced by Trump, Navy Secretary, was somehow going to be changed. That's the only reason they believe that.
Okay, well, is it going to be changed?
I don't know. I mean, and CNN doesn't know either. CNN claims they have three.
That's what they're saying. They're saying that.
No, CNN is saying it, but they don't have any. They don't have a named source, and all they're relying on. And I'm looking at CNN's reporting on this right now. They said because it's only named CVN-81 in the memo, which has to do with the electromagnetic aircraft launch system on the aircraft, that somehow they believe that the name USS Doris Miller is going to be changed because they're also referring to the ship by its official designation, which is CVN-81. In other words, CNN is full of garbage as usual.
Okay, well, did it ever come up that Donald Trump wanted his name to be on it?
I've never heard Donald Trump say that. I know that CNN would like you to believe that, and I think their story is a whole bunch of hogwash, but that's my take on it as well. Ernest, thanks for the call. Back in a moment. It's First Amendment Friday, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Portland's need.
Dropping a Portland truth bomb.
My favorite thing about living in Portland is no matter how many fentanyl overdoses happen, no matter how many tents get set up, you can't blame black people for that.
Back to Lars.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you and a real pleasure to welcome to the program Julie Hartman, who's spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Education. Ms. Hartman, welcome to the program.
Lars, thanks so much for having me on. Great to be with you.
Hey, I understand that you're going to all 50 states, and we usually make the joke that it'd be 58 if Obama was president, but that's an old joke based on something dumb that Obama said a long time ago. What are you going to all 50 states for? Because education is going to be different when the kids go back to the class this fall than it was under previous presidents?
Well, you know, Lars, I wish I could say that I'm going to all 50 states. We're doing a 50-state radio tour, so we're going through the sound waves here in all 50 states. But, you know, Secretary McMahon has visited 40 states on her returning education to the states tour because, Lars, as I'm sure you know and your listeners know, President Trump tasked Secretary McMahon with a mandate to sunset this 46-year, $3 trillion federal Department of Education in D.C., and restore authority to where it belongs with the people who are closest to the child. And that's in states, local communities, and crucially in the hands of parents. And so, you know, you were just talking about what's different going back to school this year. I want your listeners to know that this administration has made a ton of progress towards putting decision making back where it belongs among those people that I had just mentioned. We have an academic proficiency crisis, as you know, Lars, where 3 in 10 of our nation's students are not proficient in reading and math.
Yep.
I mean, this is completely insane. If we do not turn this around, how can we expect to keep up our economic might, our national security, even preserve our freedom? And so really what's happening this year is that Secretary McMahon is making sure that dollars and decision-making is going into the hands of parents and teachers and local leaders. And let me give you a few examples.
Sure, please.
The previous administration they allocated billions of dollars towards these radical DEI programs, which had no measurable connection to student outcome. I'll give you a real example, Lars. There was one program that was sponsoring queer and transgender Thai Buddhist artist PhD dissertations. Now, if you're confused listening to that, you're not alone. And, you know, taxpayer dollars shouldn't be sponsoring that when our kids can't even read. And so Secretary McMahon is putting funds into evidence-based literacy. That's one of her grant priorities, into numeracy, into supporting school choice, and really giving teachers the power to do what they do best, which is teach.
Hey, Julie, can I ask you about something in particular about that? And that is,
yes,
in the One Big Beautiful Bill, there was a provision for Americans to be able to give money to scholarship funds to fund school choice so that parents would be able to, you know, put their kids in private school, put their kids in online school, charter schools, all kinds of other school choice, rather than just have the one-size-fits-all program, which, as you point out, by the numbers, is not serving kids very well. The problem is that, you know, while people were able to donate, I think it was $1,700 into these scholarship funds and get a federal tax credit back, so that's part of what the One Big Beautiful Bill provided for, that it required that the states opt into it. And I thought a stunning number of states said, we're not going to do it, including the state I live in, the state of Washington, and I think including the state of Oregon. Is that the case? And if so, what are the reasons that these alleged leaders in states are saying we're not going to opt into a program to give kids and parents more school choice?
Well, I brought this up. This is a really, really important issue. So what you were just talking about, the Education Freedom Tax Credit, is the largest national expansion of education freedom in our nation's history. President Trump believes that parents have to be in the driver's seat to choose the best education for their child. And that can mean a lot of different things. It can mean homeschooling. It can mean tuition to private schools. It can mean after school programs and tutoring in public schools. But we need to give our kids the right support, and parents should be able to decide what that support is. And so, you know, you were saying that a lot of governors have expressed opposition to that tax credit. I actually think it's amazing how many governors have raced towards the program. There are 30 states now, red and blue states, that have opted in. And so Oregon, sadly, as you had just mentioned, continues to drag its feet. And it really is a shame, because this is a no-brainer. This is not a left versus right issue. This is about giving kids the best opportunity to succeed. And Lars, what's really important to understand about this tax credit, you are asking why people have been opposing this.
Yeah.
It comes from a huge misunderstanding about what this tax credit is. This tax credit does not take a single dollar from public school funding, no, nor does it cost state taxpayers a dime. This is all driven by private contributions to scholarship granting organizations, and it puts additional money into the education system.
But Julie, do you really think that governors of blue states are mistaken about how the program works? Or do you think they know how it works, but they feel that they have to show their loyalty to the teachers' unions by saying, we're not going to do anything that will compete with the public school model, because if we do that, the teachers' unions won't love us. And as we know, the teachers' unions love the Democrats, and they write giant campaign checks to Democrat politicians. So do you think it's about not understanding how the program works, or do you think it's more about just Democrat governors showing their loyalty, misplaced though it may be, to their friends in the teachers' unions?
Well, you know, Lars, I can't speculate as to their motives, but what
sure
Secretary McMahon...
Sure you can, Julie. Go ahead.
Well,
I do it all the time.
I'll tell you that, you know, Secretary McMahon, she's traveled the country encouraging governors to opt into this tax credit. And one of the things that she has said is, you know, by not opting in, you're not denying President Trump a victory. You're denying families a victory, parents the ultimate victory to choose the best education for their child. So, you know, we want to get all of those states opted into this tax credit. It is truly a no-brainer. And in the meantime, it's been very encouraging, though, to have seen states, both red and blue, race towards this program, because it allows parents, as I said, to really choose the best interventions for their child, whether their child attends public school or private school.
Absolutely. Give them the same kind of choice that most of the elites among Democrat elected officials, including Democrat members of Congress. They send their kids to private schools. Shouldn't average folks be able to do that as well? That's Julie Hartman. Julie is a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Education. Ms. Hartman, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Back in just a moment. It's First Amendment Friday, 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. That homeowners make in today's.
Have something to say? Give Lars a call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday. Glad to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment. A brand new EPA science chief just got a first-hand look behind the curtain. Is science actually working for us here in the Pacific Northwest? I thought we'd talk about Teresa Buasagi, who is the EPA science advisor and head of the new Office of Applied Science and Environmental Solutions. Ms. Buasagi, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So you came down to see in person what's going on in both towns like Corvallis and Newport in the state of Oregon?
I sure did. So it was my first trip, actually, to the Oregon coastline, which is a very beautiful place, I might add, probably one of the most beautiful states that I have ever been to. So it was quite an exciting opportunity, but first and foremost, I wanted to get out there to our facilities and see the work firsthand that EPA is doing. So I had an opportunity to really observe a lot of the great work that's going on there. We have some really interesting facilities, some of which are shared with Oregon State University and other local and federal partners. But there's a lot of really great science that's happening down there. So,
well, I hope you got a good reaction when you told people that your boss is Donald Trump, because this is the very, very liberal, very woke Pacific Northwest, you know.
Well, you know what? We did have the opportunity one evening while we were indulging in local seafood to kind of share some of where we were from, and folks were very welcoming, so it was much appreciated.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. So now, if you're with the Office of Applied Science and Environmental Solutions, this isn't just the pure science end of the EPA. This is where they actually find out, how do we make this stuff work? What'd you see?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked, because what I'm seeing is a lot of really interesting work that's being done. So we have a partnership with the National Estuary Program, and in particular, we're doing a lot of work up in Tillamook Bay area, where we have some autonomous sensors that are really helping us understand the true conditions that our coastal organisms and our ecosystems are experiencing. So we're getting live-time data through every 15 minutes, like what's happening with the water quality there. And that really gives us the ability to provide that information to the local community so they can make decisions, right? We understand that, you know, the oyster shellfish industry is significant, right? The Pacific Northwest, over estimated to be about $270 million a year. So by us being able to gather the data, it helps those local, communities to be able to make real-time decisions on how to best utilize that information and protect their communities, infrastructure and resources.
I guess from go ahead. Sorry, Ms. Buasagi.
No, that's okay. But, you know, I mean, my goal here is really just, you know, we're trying to solve real-world problems at Trump EPA. We're focusing on the applied science and practical solutions side of things. So I'm trying to make sure that our resources are optimized where they're making the most value differences in the communities, and we're seeing more faster and practical solutions out of that.
I'm glad to see that, because, you know, over the years, I've gathered the impression that the EPA, you end up hearing more about the EPA trying to block things from happening than actually facilitating a solution. Do you think we could ever get a federal agency that would say, instead of saying, let's figure out how to kill new ideas, how to kill new industries, but how to actually find a way to solve the problems and get people to those industries and do it in a way that takes good care of the environment at the same time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Administrator Zeldin has set the example for us, along with President Trump. I mean, and that's what we're doing, is we're trying to put those real-world solutions into place and partner with industry. And, you know, let's solve problems, not just, you know, dream about them or come up with sort of gloom and doom policies that people can't actually, you know, implement. So, yeah, we are all about implementing real-world practical solutions and utilizing innovative technologies and creative ways to solve problems. So 100%, I think you're going to see that from my team. That's the message that I'm sending loud and clear.
Ms. Buasagi, thank you very much. We appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. That's Teresa Buasagi, who is the EPA advisor and head of the new Office of Applied Science and Environmental Solutions. Glad to have you on board. This segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com. Ready to stop being a landlord? My Rocket listing will let you sell that investment property guaranteed, even with non-paying tenants, believe it or not. Go to NickShivers.com. That's NickShivers.com, and be sure to tell them Lars sent you. By the way, our X poll question today, should we provide asylum to people who need to be told not to rape? And if you wonder where that question comes from, it comes from Great Britain. In the United Kingdom, the government there this week had to start putting out pamphlets and other information to asylum seekers, most of them from the Middle East, most of them are Muslims, and they have to be told not to rape women. And the warning has to go to those asylum seekers. So I thought I'd ask you the question. If you are going to admit people to your country and provide them with asylum or refugee status, should we provide asylum to people who need to be told not to rape? I would answer, no, we shouldn't be providing asylum to people like that. We should tell them, if you've got that kind of attitude and you have to be told not to rape people, I don't think you're going to assimilate very well into our society. The X poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Yesterday's X poll question, would you buy a home in a neighborhood where your HOA uses flock cameras to track every car coming and going from the neighborhood? 90% of you agreed with me and said, no, I wouldn't buy a home in a neighborhood like that. And only 10% of you said yes to the idea of living in a home where they've decided to tell you that all the cars are going to be tracked with flock cameras as they come and go from the neighborhood. I do want to mention this. Out of the state of Idaho, which is one of the states that we serve with our Radio Northwest network, a little coffee shop in a tiny town in eastern Idaho, the owner of that shop, Jim Sheeran, had decided that he was going to tell a group of students they could not meet in his coffee shop because they were a pro-life group. And then he came out and he literally told them, I ask you guys not to meet here. He said it would be like hosting a meeting of the Klan. This is what the guy said. It's unbelievable. Kristen Hawkins, president of Students for Life America, posted a video, and we've showed the video, posted the video on Monday alleging that she and her group were actually kicked out of Idaho Roasters in Driggs, Idaho, because the owner thought a pro-life group was the same as a group backing the Klan. You got the Lars Larson
Show. The Lars Larson Show.
FM News 101. Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
Hey, looks like the Canadians are here.
866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday. This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. Always glad to get your calls. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And on First Amendment Fridays, we open up the phone lines for every subject under the sun. There's a brand new report out that says that government red tape is padding your bills by double digits. Is licensing protecting you, or is it just squeezing your wallet? I thought we'd put that question first to Edward Timmons, who is Vice President of Policy at the Archibald Institute. Mr. Timmons, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for inviting me, Lars. Always a pleasure.
Hey, would American workers prosper and do better if the states would back off on some of the crazy licensure requirements that they've invented over the last couple of decades?
Absolutely. It's very clear that they keep people out of the labor force. They raise prices. And we're not getting much in terms of benefit. It doesn't really seem to be improving the quality of services that we receive.
I mean, I understand the argument that states constantly will say, well, you know, the reason we have to license all these different professions, in some cases, as many as 180 different occupations in some states, is because we're providing for safety or making sure that people understand that when they're hiring a professional, that they get a well-trained professional. But do license requirements actually even do that?
It doesn't seem like they do. The research seems to suggest that we don't really get better quality professionals as a result of licensing, but we know that there's big costs in terms of higher prices and fewer choices for consumers.
Well, what's the best way to reform all this? Since it is done primarily at the state level, there are a few, I guess you could call the CDL, the commercial driver's license, and occupational license at the federal level. But most of the and doctors have to have some licensure that's federal, but most of this is done at the state level, isn't it?
That's right. And states vary a lot with respect to how many occupations that they license. Oregon, we found, licenses more occupations than any other state, and they're the one that licenses 180 of the 246 that we studied.
And then Missouri only does 123. Are they at the bottom of the list, or are there other states?
Yeah, Missouri's at the bottom. So that gives you a sense of the big gap that we see across states, 180 in Oregon and 123 in Missouri.
I mean, when you look at the 123, do you think there's even justification for all of those?
Absolutely not. I think every state has room for reform. And one of the things that we point out in the report are some of the unique licenses. So there's many occupations that are licensed in only a handful of states. And I think there you really have to wonder if we're the only state that's requiring a license for this profession, does it really make a lot of sense for us to keep the requirement?
Okay, so Mr. Timmons, would you mind giving my audience a few examples of some of those oddball licenses?
Yeah, absolutely. Oregon's most unique occupation is a lactation consultant. There's only two states in the country. No, I wish I was. There's only two states in the country, Oregon and Rhode Island, that license lactation consultants. Another really goofy one is interior designer. Interior designers licensed in Nevada, Louisiana, and Washington, D.C., And those are the only states and jurisdiction where you have to obtain a license in order to work as an interior designer. It's hard to imagine what sort of argument you can make about bad interior design or why we need to license interior designers for safety.
Why, lives might be at stake if you let the wrong person come in and do interior design. It does sound kind of goofy. Is most of this just driven, or was it driven by maybe legislation written to basically engage in restraint of trade, you know, to protect people's occupational areas by saying, don't let anybody else come in and do interior design?
That's exactly right. And in fact, the professional groups oftentimes have model legislation and post strategies on their website about how to push for licensing in states. So it's very much an attempt by these professional groups to limit competition and to try to dictate what aspiring workers have to do in order to begin working.
Well, because there seems to be so much concern by the federal DOJ about big companies sometimes merging. I think of Spirit and JetBlue. I think of the recent proposed merger between Paramount and Warner. And they're worried about things that will be anti-competitive that will end up hurting consumers. Does the federal DOJ ever play a role in how states license professions? Because I would think that would be closer to affecting the people of those states in their day-to-day activities when things like lactation consultants have to get a license.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Department of Justice has on occasion commented on specific licensing provisions. Like veterinarians are one of the worst of the bunch. They'll try to dictate and force individuals to just have a veterinarian site or to have a veterinarian nearby whenever a pet is getting a rabies vaccine, even if it's very clear that a pet has fleas, you can visually see them, they'll force the pet owner to take their pet to the office to get treated. And the Department of Justice has made clear that a lot of these practices are clearly anti-competitive and are in need of reform. So, yeah, the federal government does get involved on occasion, and I think you're spot on. I think the Department of Justice, the Federal Trade Commission, should pay more attention to these professional associations that are really restricting competition and driving up price and restricting choice for consumers.
Do you see any states out there that are actually taking the lead and saying we ought to go back and start looking at some of these and de-licensing some areas?
Yeah, there's a couple of states that do pretty well. Utah is a state that stands out. They actually have a separate entity that reviews occupational licensing, makes recommendations for reform, and they've made some significant progress in recent years. Ohio is another state. Ohio, in our report, got rid of two licenses. They were the state that moved the most in terms of reducing barriers to enter in our report. And they have a regular review process that the legislators undertake in order to make sure that licensing is, in fact, serving consumers' best interests and not the professionals' best interests.
Be nice if they all went that direction. Mr. Timmons, thanks very much. That's Edward Timmons, who's Vice President of Policy at the Archibald Institute. I'll be glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network, abortion pills delivered right to your mailbox. Did Joe Biden's DOJ rewrite the rules to make more babies die? Look your best. And so the plan was to name an aircraft carrier, the latest Gerald Ford class aircraft carrier, after Dory Miller, the USS Dory Miller. And now CNN is saying, based on the thinnest of evidence, that somehow they're not going to name it after Dory Miller, but instead they're going to name it after Donald Trump. Except when you look deep into the reporting by CNN, they don't have a single thing other than a couple of unnamed sources and a memo that refers to the aircraft carrier by its official designation, which is CVN-81, which doesn't tell you anything. And it certainly doesn't say that it's going to be named for Donald Trump. And I'd remind you, as you hear that story, all the other organizations that are reporting this, like Politico and The Guardian and others, they all refer back to the CNN report. So if the CNN report is hogwash, that means all the other reporting on it is hogwash as well. But there's a second story, and it has to do with Donald Trump and the American Bar Association. And Neary called in from our Seattle affiliate, KVI, to ask about that. Neary, welcome to the program on First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Oh, yeah. Well, I overheard that thing, and so apropos to your previous segment of licensing.
Yeah.
Here you go. It's another licensing that seems to be now just a hogwash with all the bias that there is in that little organization that got bastardized by the Democrats.
You're talking about the American Bar Association, right?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and what the Trump administration has been doing is for about the last 75 years, the ABA, the American Bar Association, bunch of lawyers, that they are a private organization, and they decide which law schools get accreditation and which schools are not given accreditation. So it's a very important authority. They accredit about 200 different law schools as of about 5 years ago. And so that gives the ABA a lot of throw weight when it comes to the law. The problem is the ABA lately has been pushing DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, or as some people translated, didn't earn it. And DEI is not what you want when it comes to lawyers. So if the ABA is going to accredit law schools or not accredit law schools, and they're going to push DEI, I think Donald Trump is right to strip the ABA of its authority to accredit law schools. What do you think, Mary?
Well, tried with medical the same way. I mean, like having DEI doctor, and let's see how long you people will live.
Do you know there is a great story, Neary, and it involves a doctor from the 70s, and it involved a case called Bakke. And there was a guy who wanted to go to medical school, and he was a white guy, and he was denied entry to the medical school, and they instead gave the slot, his slot in medical school that he had earned with his, you know, his test scores and everything else, they gave it to another applicant instead. And that applicant became a doctor. He was a person of color, and he became a doctor, and he ended up killing some of his patients. He was a terrible doctor, but he was one of the early examples of DEI going sideways and actually taking people's lives. And I'll cite some great columns that were written by a guy who wrote for the Boston Globe, named Jeff Jacoby, who wrote some absolutely brilliant columns about this whole mess and about the fact that people were still citing the Bakke case years later. People like Ted Kennedy saying, look, we've got to give people an early into, say, medical school or law school or whatever. When they've done it with DEI, it literally can end up taking people's lives.
Yeah, that's my problem is, meritocracy when it's not meritocracy when it's not let's put it warranted, and giving somebody what you would call authority of your life.
Yep.
When they're not warranted to this, let's see. But even in leadership, let's say Zohran Mamdani and then AOC, and they never worked a day in the life. I'm sorry, AOC was a bartender, and that's qualified.
Yeah, she was a bartender.
Zohran Mamdani was a rapper. That the other gaggles of baboons from the DSA never worked a day. Oh, Wilson, our mayor, also never worked a day in the life. And now they're going to lead up a city?
Yeah, somebody who can't pay her own bills. I mean, imagine this. What Neary's talking about is the socialist mayor of the city of Seattle, the 13th or 14th biggest city in America, is a young woman who's never had a real job in her life. Her mommy and daddy have paid her bills. She is 41 years old. She's married. She has a husband. She has a child, but she's never had a real job. Her husband doesn't have a real job either. And now she's the mayor in charge of one of the largest cities in the United States of America. And you wonder, how do you get a job like that? How do you get a job as mayor to run a multi-billion dollar city budget and a police department and everything else? How do you get that when you've never had any position of responsibility ever before in your life? It's a real mystery, isn't it?
Yes, and that's my problem. My problem is, like, are we led by baboons or are we led by people? Because it just seems to me that the circus is never ending.
You know, I would think that even in the animal kingdom, Mary, you've mentioned baboons a couple of times, but even among animals, if you're going to be the chief elephant in the herd, Do you think they pick the scrawny one who's never actually accomplished anything? Or do you think they actually pick the elephant who's big and strong and capable and all of that? It's First Amendment Friday. It's a pleasure to be with you. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Coming up in just a moment, a 16-year-old says her school ignored her assault report for months, and now a federal judge is stepping in. We'll talk about that coming up next.
The Lars Larson Show.
Portland's news, traffic, and weather.
Lars reads every email. No, really. Talk at LarsLarson.com. That's talk at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. A 16-year-old girl says that her school just ignored her report of being assaulted for months, and now a federal judge is stepping in. Does Title IX actually protect young ladies in our society, or is it currently failing them? I thought we'd turn to our friend, the reporter Carlene Johnson, who writes for the Center Square, who's been following the case involving Callie Keeler, and it's one in which every time I look at this one, Carlene, I think it would be so easy for the school authorities to have done the right thing, and yet at every turn, they seem to just say, nope, we're not going to do the right thing. Am I wrong in that assessment?
No, I think you're 100% right, Lars. They really messed up, and that's why you've got, you know, the principal and, charged criminally, which we don't usually see that. But, and you got the Trump administration investigating the Puyallup school district as well. But I know you've seen the video, and I'm guessing, knowing your audience, that a lot of them have seen that video of Callie. Yeah, on the wrestling mat. Last December, she's been wrestling since she was four, and she's a strong young woman. She was 15 at the time. She goes to the mat in a tournament, doesn't know that her competitor is biological male, and he pins her, and you've seen the video. I don't need to describe it.
Well, because it's a family show,
yep.
Arlene. Let's just say this. You understand that when you're wrestling, you often put your hands on your opponent in all kinds of places you wouldn't ordinarily. And this young biological male ends up putting his hand where it definitely does not belong on Callie Keeler. Is that a fair way of summing it up?
Yeah, and I think people can probably get the gist of it. We're not talking about the top half of her. We're talking about the lower half. And she grimaced. Her mom's, taking video. You can see her looking at her mom like, oh, God, what just happened to me? Looks terrified. And a couple of seconds later, she lets herself get pinned so that the match ends, and then finds out that was a dude. And the problem is they reported it. She and her mom went to the school and reported it the very next week or the very next day. I think it was like 2 days later.
Yep.
And the school sat on it. They sat on it. They started investigating internally. But guess what? As a school, you're mandatory reporters. Any school district employee, like police, like doctors, counselors, whatever, you're all mandatory reporters. They had an obligation to report to police. They didn't go to police until podcaster Brandy Cruz and then me 2 days later wrote up the article. And then they went, we probably should have reported this. Oops.
And by the way, I'm talking to Carlene Johnson, whose reporting is found at the Center Square. You point out that under the state's mandatory reporting law, every state in America has a mandatory reporting law. Sometimes they differ slightly on who is a mandatory reporter. But in general, people who are in positions of responsibility, like teachers, like doctors, like cops, people like that, they're required to report it within 48 hours. And if it's that clear cut in the law, what excuse at all can they give for their failure to report?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of it was, we got to deal with this internally. Was she really sexually assaulted or not? But guess what? That doesn't matter. It wasn't their call to decide if, in fact, she'd been assaulted or not. She reports that she was. I don't care if they even think she's full of it and nothing happened. They don't get to decide not to report that. That is against the law. And that's why they are now criminally charged. You've got a new superintendent in the district. And, this is a, This one, I think it's already made national headlines, but I have a feeling these guys are actually going to be, you know, follow through. The charges are going to result in some kind of conviction on these guys.
You know what I'd like to see after things like this happen, Carlene? I would love it if nationwide, at least within the region where this happened, that you would have school administrators say, we are going to tell everybody on our faculty, here's a memo. The memo says you are a mandatory, if you're working in this school, you're a mandatory reporter. If anything like this happens, and then list off all the other obvious, the ones that may not, apparently are not obvious enough to coaches and teachers and everybody else, and say, if you run into this, any situation like this, and you fail to report it, you may be criminally charged. Now, a memo like that sent out to all staff, which would cost next to nothing. It's the cost of an email sent to the staff of schools and school districts and everything else, would make it abundantly clear. We've put you all on notice. This is what you're required to do. Fail to do it, and you may be looking literally at a jail cell. And yet, have you heard about a single school or school district that's acted in that way?
No, and this would be another one of those cases where the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction and Superintendent Chris Rakedahl, like you say, he could put out a blast to all 295 public school districts in the state of Washington that says, reminder, since maybe somebody messed up here big time and it's probably going to cost, you know, a lot of money in lawsuit payouts, remember, you're a teacher, you're a counselor, you're a coach. You don't get to not report things like this.
Do you get the impression, though, that people like Chris Rakedahl don't actually believe in mandatory reporting of stuff like this?
Well, he certainly believes that it's okay to have biological males play against females in sports. We know that. We've got the initiative that's going to be on the November 3 ballot here to protect girls' sports and keep boys out of our locker rooms and bathrooms, which they do. The boys go in the girls' bathrooms. Trust me, I've still got a senior in high school this year, and they're doing it. But yeah, so we know where he stands on it. So I don't anticipate we're going to see anything from Rakedahl's office.
No, but
you're right. They should.
They should, and it would be easy to do. And the fact that they're going to fail kids in this way, I got to tell you, I'm talking to Carlene Johnson from the Center Square. I think this is one of the reasons why across the entire country, you're seeing parents right and left pulling their kids out of the toxic government-run so-called public schools.
Absolutely. And I would do it. I would do it if my daughter is in public school. She's got one more year. She's hardly going to be at the high school this year because she's doing Running Start. But, you know, I just told her, and she said, God, Mom, I'd want out if I was just starting over again. And I would encourage people to really consider it if it's at all possible, because there's so much damage being done. And some of the harms can't be undone at this point. But you got some messed up kids.
Well, you know, I can suggest something to any parents who are listening. Here's what I would suggest to you, and it's entirely legal, it's within the law, and it's within your reach. If anything like this happens to any of your kids, you go straight to the police, and you say, I'm going to report an assault, and I insist that you take the report, and if they defer or say, no, we'd rather handle it through the school, say, if you're not going to take the report, I will go public. I will go to the media. And I will say, I've reported the assault on my son or my daughter to the police, and the police refuse to take it. And they're saying because they want to hide it under a rock somewhere. And just tell them that. And I think that's the one way you could actually get some action, is to tell the police, I'm reporting an assault. And if you won't take the report of an assault, I'll go to the district attorney, I'll go to the prosecutor, I'll go to all those other authorities, and then I'll go to the media. And then you guys can all have egg on your faces and maybe a time in a jail cell at some point. That's Carlene Johnson from the Center Square. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. You're side by side.
Missed the Lars Larson Show? Get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment. There's a reason we call this the best conversation in talk journalism, and you're invited to join in at 866-HEY-LARS. Answer our X poll question. We post a brand new poll every day from the news of the day at Lars Larson Show on X and on my website at LarsLarson.com, and you can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. I'm really happy to welcome to the program Derek Bars, who is the Administrator of Federal Motor Carrier Safety for the United States Department of Transportation. Mr. Bars, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, sir. It's good to be with you.
Well, I'm glad to have you on, and here's the thing I'm concerned about. If I overstate or incorrectly state this, feel free to correct me because I want my audience to get the right information. But right now, the Trump administration would like to make sure that everybody who's behind the wheel of a big rig out there, and which requires a commercial driver's license, that all of them know how to speak and read the signs that direct and regulate traffic, and that they are qualified to have that CDL that they have in their pocket. And I'm concerned because I've told my audience over the last couple of years about some really horrendous occurrences where fake CDL carriers, people who don't have a good license, don't know how to read the language, have ended up causing accidents that have taken people's lives and hurt them badly. So would you mind telling my audience what the US DOT and your agency, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, is doing to try to clean up the roles of CDL holders?
Well, thank you very much. And you said that absolutely accurately. Over the last year, we have been working extremely hard to work on these particular issues, knowing that we have a problem when it comes to issuances of CDLs and what they call non-domiciled CDLs, individuals who are not from this country, have come over and are trying to obtain a driver's license. And over the last year, as I mentioned, we've done investigations and we have found that these have been issued improperly. Individuals have been issued these licenses to drive 80,000-pound commercial motor vehicles across the country, not just in one state, but across all states in the country, with these licenses who should not have been issued them in the first place. So we've done a lot of audits of all of our 50 states, and we have some states that worked really closely with us, and they had stopped the issuances of these licenses until they got their system straight. And then there's others who have just thumbed their nose at us and saying, we're not going to stop issuing them. We're not going to follow what you've asked us to do. We also have a new rule that's in place. It's the non-domiciled rule and what can actually be issued, the types of individuals who can receive these non-domiciled CDLs. So that's been limited to, H-2A, H-2B, and E-2 visa holders. And so, that's proper documentation for immigration to be able to verify who these individuals are before they're actually given a CDL. And it's about making sure that we have compliant and we know we've got good qualified individuals behind the wheel. But to be honest with you, that is just the first step. The second step, of course, that you should be able to read, or not read, but actually understand the English language to be able to read road signs. So I guess that is right, to read road signs and to have an interaction with law enforcement if you happen to be involved in a crash or a roadside inspection that need to be done. And we are seeing we've had thousands and thousands of individuals who have been placed out of service who can't operate the commercial motor vehicle because they can't speak the language or they can't understand the language or they can't read the road signs. And I'll just give you a classic example.
Sure.
I was recently out on a traffic stop with a Florida state trooper where I used to work for many years. And we asked the driver, where are you going? He said, Miami Beach. I said, what are you hauling in the back of your truck? He said, Miami Beach. I said, well, where did you come from? He said, Miami Beach. Was unable to have a conversation, unable to provide me with a bill of lading, unable to tell me what's in the back of the load of the truck. So, again, you get the gist of what I'm actually saying here. So
I'll
stop there. But what you're saying is absolutely right to make sure. I was a law enforcement officer for 30 years before I took this job at U.S. Department of Transportation.
Well, I'm glad to see you doing what you're doing, because I think you could clean up this very easily. In fact, your home state of Florida, I noticed that their way stations have simply been saying, we're going to pull drivers off, and if they're in there to weigh their truck, but they can't speak the language, they don't meet the qualifications, they don't have a legitimate CDL, they're going to be pulled off the road. Are the blue states, the 20 or so blue states that are blue politically, in America, are they the ones that, you know, because I want to make it easy for my audience to understand. This is a blue state problem where they're saying, we're not going to help you get the bad CDL drivers off the road. Am I wrong about that?
Well, there are a lot of states that are willing to work with us, and there's others who are not willing to work with us. And you're absolutely right that these blue states that you're referring to are the ones who are more resistant than the others to be able to work with us. And here, at the end of the day, this is not a political issue. This is a safety issue. We are working to improve safety no matter what part of the country that they're in, because that driver can drive in a red state, a blue state, a purple state. It doesn't really matter. But you and I are also traveling on those roadways, and we want to make sure that the individuals are qualified, they've been through the proper training, and they can understand the rules of the road to make sure that we reduce the number of crashes that we're having in this country.
Okay, so tell me this. What is the excuse that these states that are not cooperating, no matter what their politics are, what's the excuse they're using for withholding information from the federal government that actually is the, you know, is the backing behind a CDL? A CDL is not a state license. It's a federal license. While issued by the state, it's still a federal license. So what excuse are they using for holding back the info?
I can't understand why they would not be willing to work with us on these issues. I mean, we're actively trying to protect the issuance of fraudulent DL driver's licenses, foreign bad actors. It goes into when we begin doing regulatory enforcement, we see criminal nature that is happening, and we refer those over to our criminal law enforcement partners. And so the information that we have that we need to be able to investigate and to make sure that people are compliant. So I'm not sure exactly the reason why you're not willing to work with us and work with all forms of law enforcement, regulatory agencies to ensure that safety on our roadways. Again, I'll go back to, we want to make sure we're working with them, but I can't understand why they would want to protect individuals who are not legally to be in this country to be behind the wheel of a commercial motor vehicle.
That's Derek Bars. He is the administrator of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. We'll be back in just a moment, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
FM News 101.